Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for February 9th, 2025, the cover story, The Joy of X. In an era plagued by sex negativity, only one generation seems immune, mine. And then from the diagnosis section, bloat remover. And finally, from the Screenland section, pull together. Some of LA's fires were put out quickly. There are lessons in that. But first, The Joy of X. In an era plagued by sex negativity, only one generation seems immune, mine. This article was written by Murray Silkoff. In 2019, I divorced at age 46 and went on to have more and better sex than I ever would have thought possible. I had not imagined that the end of a 20-year relationship would mean a new era of high eroticism. I'd have needed to be delusional to think that. I was middle-aged with two young children, a bunch of chronic illness, and a bank account that was essentially handed over to divorce lawyers. My career was on life support, and after years away in bigger cities, I was back in my hometown, Montreal, enduring the kind of isolation that comes from exiting a relationship that has defined nearly half your life. Then the pandemic hit. And yet. In the beginning, I thought it was just my own cool and unusual story. Returning to plentiful sex in my late 40s felt weirdly intuitive, like hearing an old favorite song and finding that, of course, I still knew all the words. There were new frills. I'd cook decadent meals, buy absurd lingerie, pretend that I always had Japanese whiskey hanging around. But I also found that I was better at sex, and this was because I was older. I had fewer inhibitions, fewer hang-ups, and more self-love than I did as a taut 24-year-old. And the culture of sex in the 2020s felt more exploratory, more forgiving. The date rapes and creepy professors that filled my 1990s were gone. The workplace harassment and idiotic full Brazilians that peppered my early 2000s were over. The fear of pregnancy was finished, as was the pressure to land a partner to make babies with. Everything that remained felt like a privilege. There was desire, and there was the ability to fulfill it. It turns out this was not just my story. 5 years since that divorce, it seems clear that what I have been doing privately is part of something bigger, a story that somehow belongs to my generation, and particularly the women of my generation. The media's confirming this has been kind of unrelenting. A few months ago, Netflix served me a scrolling bar of options labeled Grown-Ass Women Living Their Best Lives, full of movies about middle-aged women unrepentantly getting it on, not because they were weak, but because they had arrived. Last year brought not one, but two movies in which an accomplished, tastefully dressed Nicole Kidman, 57, has a sexual affair with a much younger man, and one in which an accomplished, tastefully dressed Laura Dern, 57, does the same. In literature, the 56-year-old actor Gillian Anderson put out Want, a collection of female sexual fantasies. Glynis McNichol, 50, wrote, I'm mostly here to enjoy myself, a popular memoir about going to Paris to get laid. Molly Roden Winter wrote the salacious More about her open marriage. And, of course, there was Miranda July's blockbuster novel, All Fours, a barmy midlife sextravaganza, which the New York Times named the first great perimenopausal novel, and which contained so many uncannily truth-telling moments that it nearly exploded all my messaging apps with shared photos of its pages. A whole new cultural type seems to have landed. It feels worlds away from the traditional view of older women's sexuality, which, if you look at the lion's share of studies, you would conclude is incredibly depressing. Until the late 20th century, academic studies of aging women were dominated by what sociologists called the misery perspective, which emphasizes how people's lives get worse as they age, burdened by factors like chronic illness and financial distress. Spend time reading papers with titles like "We're Just Tired," "Influences on Sexual Activity Among Male-Partnered Women in Midlife," and you will emerge with a dour picture of what it means to be sexual and female at 50, a deflating biomedical index of problems, from diminished libido to painful sex to vaginal atrophy to breasts with no sensitivity. You will read about the possibility of new partners being ransacked by caregiving responsibilities, how if you have a 10-year-old at home or an 80-year-old in a home or both, chances are you are not out shopping for slinky skivvies to wear for liquid dinners, adieu in bed. Add to this a ratio issue rooted partly in the habit of men's linking up with younger women, and the picture becomes even more grim. But this year I looked around at the women I know and saw a completely different plane of existence. The women I know is, by definition, not a representative sample, but still. Two of my friends ended marriages because of their own sexual dissatisfaction. Another divorced and became a card-carrying polyamorist. Two of my friends in their 50s are seriously dating people in their 30s, and a few others, like me, divorced and engaging in sex practices they'd never tried before. I'm sure that every one of us recognizes aspects of the misery perspective in all those papers, but it does not describe our lives right now. I can tell because when one of us needs an endometrial ablation for unrelenting perimenopausal bleeding, or a hysterectomy for fibroids growing larger than citrus fruits, or agrees to take an aging parent or a partner's kids into her home, a big question inevitably seems to be, what will this do to my sex life? I have come to think of this cadre of women as something like hardy garden perennials. Year after year, with the right conditions, perennials continue to flower. Likewise, the sexual perennial finds herself still well-rooted in an erotic life at an age when she may have expected it to fade or wither. This is all the more remarkable because, for the culture as a whole, physical sex really is withering and fading. Among the most defining ongoing stories about sex in America today has been the drop-off in activity among Gen Z and millennials. Blame for that decline has generally been placed on the way we live in the 21st century. The atomization of our social lives, the antidepressants that can kill the libido, the phones and social media that provide endless fascination, even on boring evenings when other things could be happening, the always available porn that offers both problematic expectations of how in-person sex happens and a far less demanding alternatives to it. For young parents, the intensity of modern child-rearing shrivels sex lives. For teenagers, a growing obsession with personal and psychological safety, a desire to be immune from discomfort, can flatten eroticism in some of the places it might flourish. Last year, I even saw one survey that, at a glance, seemed to me to suggest that people in their late 40s and early 50s might be having sex more frequently than those between 18 and 24. When I got in touch with the generational researcher, Jean Twenge, whose best-selling books, most recently Generations, have done much to explain the differences among birth cohorts, she was skeptical of those findings. But the subtler data she did pull up, mainly using general social survey data from 1989 to 2022, still made a clear case for a kind of maverick sexiness among those currently in middle age. When you track sexual frequency among age groups, something notable happens around 2007. A downward curve in activity among people 18 to 40 that turns into a sheer nosedive in the decade that follows. Today's young adults are having sex 30% less often than young adults in the early 2000s. Such declines have occurred across the generational spectrum, but one generation, in its middle age, is experiencing a much less pronounced drop from the sexual frequency of its predecessors. Using the same measures, Twenge says, the drop among Generation X is pretty small. It's only 9%. The sexual perennials of this generation do not fit neatly into any of the well-trodden archetypes of older women. Like the cougar or the MILF, these degrading male gaze notions of women precariously perched on the brink of undesirability. Pop culture is only now beginning to create new symbols of them, while those of the past feel silly or peculiar. In the 1980s, Blanche Devereaux of the Golden Girls was often portrayed as a swooning, silk-draped clown for merely having a libido. At the start of that series, she was supposed to be around 53, which is 2 years younger than Jennifer Lopez is now. The perennial's vibe is not about finding a pocket of succor after the sun of youth has set. It is rather a power stance, a matter of caring less and less about such expectations the older you get. I would love to imagine that this development is a permanent one, that the culture is finding a lasting perch for the sexuality of all older women. But I cannot shake a strong hunch that what we are seeing among middle-aged women is a function of the specific generation currently occupying those years. This is a cohort of women with formative experiences that do not resemble those of the generation surrounding them, a generation that began having sex earlier than any other on record, that stayed on the singles market for years longer than their parents, that is continuing to have sex even amid a broader sexual decline. I do not think it is a coincidence that the women I've written about thus far are part of Generation X, born between 1965 and 1980. Gen X, a small generation compared with relatively larger cohorts like millennials or Gen Z, kind of dodged a bullet, Twenge told me, by which she meant that while our lonely iPhone-defined century came for everyone's libido, some were defined by it, while others were merely affected. By the time the 21st century really landed, much of Generation X was already largely formed in terms of sexual habit. And this may be why, in middle age, it is shaping up to be possibly the sexiest generation on record. You can even make the statement, Twenge said, that Gen X is the last sexy generation. I was born in about the middle of the Gen X span in 1973. Like many Gen Xers, I lost my virginity early, in my case, at 15. By 2007, when the iPhone was introduced and the spiral of American sexual decline becomes highly visible, I was 34 and had been sexually active for nearly two decades. My sex ed was thoroughly analog, which is to say human and exploratory, because there was no alternative. The internet was barely public. Home computing was confined to blinking greenish screens, and porn did not live on the surface of culture. If you wanted it, it was something you had to seek out in public places that were either embarrassing, newsstands, or creepy, bead-curtained back rooms, squalid theaters. So the way I figured out sex was all over the city, in guys' houses or the field near my high school, in the back office of the boutique where I worked, in nightclubs entered with fake ID. Today, as a mother to two children whose whereabouts I am in 100% constant awareness of, I think of my own pubescence with not a little bewilderment. I had parents and step-parents, and yet my childhood feels decidedly Peanuts-like in its absence of grown-ups. The public service refrain Americans were treated to at the time, "It's 10 p.m., do you know where your children are?" sounds absolutely surreal today, when modern parenting has so thoroughly glued our children to the sides of our bodies. I remember spending my youth in all kinds of places, libraries, swimming pools, parks, cafes, the subway, with sometimes random bunches of other people. Kids I knew, kids I didn't, kids who were good and kids who were problems. We were expected to figure out these interpersonal dynamics, the general weirdness that is other people, on our own. Some have called Gen X a forgotten generation. Others have labeled it neglected by parents whose 1960s and 1970s self-centering rendered children something of a nuisance. But the free-range vibe of the era's parenting feels like a circumstantial issue as much as a choice. My divorced mother worked, but unlike the typical family in previous eras, there was no easy intergenerational arrangement to take care of me while she was not home, and unlike now, there was no question of my father's helping out after school ended at 3:45, nor school daycare programs for households like mine. Like so many others of my generation, I rode home on the city bus, let myself in, watched Three's Company with a box of Ritz crackers, and eventually grew up to make jokes about having been raised by wolves. Much of this generation learned to fend for itself young. Gen X was, on some level, the last generation to be raised this way, before new standards of safety and ideas about parental responsibility made children far more predominant in their guardians' schedules. For women, that toughness would come in handy in the 1990s, the decade during which most of today's middle-aged people came of age. When I first had sex, I remember rushing home to call a girlfriend and tell her the news. There was a real sense of relief, of growing closer to hallowed adulthood, something we all wanted badly, not realizing this was partly because we were launched out of childhood too early. You need not take my word for this. The teenage birth rate was no small crisis in the 1990s and dropped by 78% from 1991 to 2022. At the time, it mattered less to me that, while fooling around, the guy in question had forced himself into me. That part was unpleasant, but it felt, as an occurrence, normal enough. Looking back now, I find it insane that I did not recognize that I was raped. Even when I heard discussions about date rape a few years later, I remember feeling somewhat mewling or imposter-like, counting myself as a victim. At the time, I just moved on, largely into a queer nightclub scene where I found what became a kind of home and a family. I did not yet much even like sex, but I had a lot of partners, and if something went wrong with a condom or if another surprise entry occurred, I would go to a clinic and get a morning after pill or an STD test, as if I were picking up a particularly terrifying coffee. In 1991, when I was 18 and starting college, I was in a voguing house that won Montreal's first Vogue ball. By 1992, two out of the five members of the house were dead from AIDS, and one was HIV positive. When I think of sex in those years, fun is not the first word that comes to mind. In his book, The Naughty 90s, David Friend quotes Kathleen Hanna, the front woman of the Riot Girl band Bikini Kill, describing her 90s feminism in a Times interview by saying that she didn't just hit the glass ceiling, she pressed her naked breasts up against it. In its chicky, disobedient boastfulness, Hanna's line feels so of this era. And yet today it invites a double take. Wouldn't it be better for her to not be naked? But as Friend demonstrates, sex coated what felt like every corner of the 1990s culture, even to the highest echelons of power. Bill Clinton's Oval Office semen stains, the Clarence Thomas hearings talk of long dong silver, Prince Charles telling his mistress, Camilla Parker Bowles, that he might be reincarnated as her Tampax. The ambience of female sexual emancipation and girl power was increasingly in the mainstream, but the surrounding culture was still entrenched in the kind of ogling, cigar-chomping sexism you might associate with earlier eras. Women were often tightly whale-boned into the most predictable sex roles, either fending off rapacious men or, as the decade deepened, appearing in movies and magazines as sex-crazed nymphettes who could never get enough. By the time I finished college, I had integrated my own rather saw-toothed sexual history into a tough-as-nails, big-as-the-boys form of Camille Paglia-esque feminism. This wisecracking persona was nearly necessary at the Montreal newspaper where I worked, and where I endured more than one editorial meeting sitting on the lap of my editor. One Halloween, a fellow journalist showed up at a party in only tight white underwear and a cape, claiming to be dressed as Rape Man. This was not an environment I often questioned. I remember dreaming up ways to cultivate and exude a kind of tomboy fatale stance of high ennui, an irony-steeped seen-it-all, whatever type of womanhood, synonymous at the time with hipness and credibility. Cool women didn't whine. We rolled our eyes at everything. I might even have imagined that being able to work under a heavy broom of machismo and high sexual charge while submitting copy that was clean was itself a kind of girl power. Of course, this protective cover ensured that such a workplace could run unobstructed. I do not want to suggest that today's perennial is simply a calloused product of so much formative chaos. The point is that today's less toxic, less male-dominated sexual landscape might feel like a particularly nice and even forgiving landing place for women who lived through that era. Sexual frequency may have waned among the young, but the young have also helped to create a kinder and more open-minded world of sex, full of body positivity and gender questioning, consent culture, and the acceptance of all kinds of desire. Also, a recognition that the adult supervision of an HR department can be a positive thing. In encountering all this, the Gen X woman, my post-divorce self very included, might feel as if she has reached some kind of welcoming flip side. She was primed for hardcore jungle combat in a pencil skirt, and now, so many years later, finds herself in a womb-like bouncy castle where women are invited not just to have orgasms, but also to have important conversations about their orgasms. Just as in all those movies on Netflix, the rise of the perennial does feel like something of an intergenerational dance. What happens when the mores of one age cohort intermingle with those of others? In so many memoirs and films and TV shows, the older women are found in relation to younger men. It doesn't track as cougarism. It feels more like serendipity. Even beyond the fact that you can now buy clitoral stimulators at the pharmacy, and even insensitive dudes have heard that they shouldn't shove themselves inside you without you're okay, the very possibility of the perennial has emerged from a random scrum of factors. You have women who found themselves free of marriage in middle age. In 1980, the median age for women getting their first divorce was about 30. In 2020, it was around 40. You have women who are more educated and earn more than ever. You have women who are interpersonally rugged and who can be light and easy with sex because they worked their way through so much difficult sex when they were young. And you have women who are, in certain ways, immune to the neutering forces of the 21st century because, both sexually and socially, they were formed before it. Nearly every woman I spoke to for this article, from Gillian Anderson to old girlfriends from my first newspaper jobs, mentioned that she felt as if she was living in a lovely interstice. It's like right now the lights are on, Anderson said. We are open for business, and it's not just that we are not giving up. We want to do more, and maybe there is this thirst to do it now. I myself have seen, as menopause has come into the picture, how my libido has subtly changed, how the rampant desire and thoughtless lubrication that were available to me even 4 years ago, when I first divorced, take a little more work now. Sometimes on days when my whole body hurts for no reason I can fathom, and the lines between my nose and the corners of my mouth make me feel as if I resemble a sad walrus, and my parents are angry at me for God knows what boomerish reason, and my kids are mounting campaigns for still more screen time, and the work and overwhelm are peaking to the point when a shower seems like a faraway dream, I, too, feel much more at home in the misery perspective. The fleetingness is built in, and it might make the experience of being sexually existent in middle age feel even more special. What need not be fleeting is the effect this new opening could have on younger generations. When I first divorced, I sometimes tried to imagine aspects of my life as seen through the eyes of my two daughters, wondering if they found my romantic revitalization, something I did not think could be entirely hidden from them, to be weird. I was different from the flattened married mother they knew until then, and I knew from my own experience as a child of divorce that what happens to your parents after a split can sink in deep, reframing a child's whole sense of what adulthood is like. I thought about it a lot. For my own children, what messages about life and age and womanhood were being instilled? This may be the lasting question for today's perennials. What are we setting up our daughters for? And will it be good? Some aspects of the type being created today are clearly worrisome. It feels, for instance, tied to, or is at the very least happening concurrently with, the fact that today's 50-year-old women, not least the famous ones, can look the way women of 50 have never looked, sculpted, dewy, pert, with long manes and line-free brows and flat abs and blindingly white teeth. But for the middle-aged, I would venture, more exhausting. No matter how self-loving, I do not think there is a 50-year-old woman on earth who does not stand in the mirror at some point and feel as if some part of her body is melting like a candle over itself. Yet, the general understanding, even in more enlightened offerings like Miranda July's All Fours, is that physical aging is something that can be dealt with, a hurdle to be jumped over in order to be primed for sex. For July's protagonist, the realization that her butt no longer looks round and contained but long, like a pair of fat arms, inspires a regime of workouts to make her backside so lifted it would choke me. The message is that the perennial works when the perennial works out. All she needs is money and insane amounts of time and effort, and soon enough knowledge of where to get Botox and fillers and lasers and bioidentical hormones and keratin hair treatments and vaginal rejuvenation and God knows what else. This aesthetic youthification, which brings the tyranny of a 20-something defined hotness ever higher up the age range, to places where it is harder and harder to attain, feels apparent in movies such as The Substance featuring 62-year-old Demi Moore and Baby Girl with Kidman as the cryogenically nubile Romy. Both purport to comment on sexism and ageism, while the youth-focused bodies and faces of their leads, these Everest-like achievements in Pilates or cosmetic alteration, play what feels like a co-starring role. This is one road we could thoughtlessly amble down, one defined by youth, as if youth remained the only place where sex really belonged. We could embrace an aesthetic of privilege, bifurcating the women who can and the women who can't. I worry even that by writing about any of this, I could be aiding the creation of a pressurized container, a standard that makes women feel bad or deficient for aging poorly if they are not having sex or not interested in it. All we will have accomplished in this case is to confine women within the same old rules of youth for an extra decade or two before they are exiled, just as they were before. And maybe people like my daughters will look at 50-something women with that extra shirt button undone and think only that old people are embarrassing horn dogs still clinging to 20th century licentiousness, and that relative asexuality is the better option. But what the perennial has for herself right now is something far better than all that, something that can stand up against the old rules of youth. There is research on this too. Contra the misery perspective of aging, a new school called critical gerontology has focused on the positive effects of aging, including improved sex lives for women. According to Lisa Miller, author of the 2019 study, The Perils and Pleasures of Aging, many women in middle age and beyond are now finding their sexual voice, experimenting and claiming the right to be satisfied. This is what I see around me. These women enjoy the most beautiful spoils of aging, things like caring less about social standards that they no longer have use for, or being more comfortable in their bodies precisely because they have lived in them for so long. It would be a shame if these benefits turned out to be nothing more than a temporary sweet spot that only one small generation lucked its way into. It is not simply about stretching the mores of youth. It can hold a much deeper meaning, an acceptance that the chapters of life have, over the past few decades, been reshuffled, and that there are more chapters than there used to be. I'm not telling you that 50 is the new 30. I am saying that when life's milestones are moved around, new opportunities are created. My younger daughter often marvels, or maybe just scratches her head, over the fact that I'm twice the age of some of the other mothers in the schoolyard, and yet nothing like a grandmother. Even though many of the women around me also had children in their late 30s or early 40s, this is information my kid is clearly unsure what to do with, her mother living in this unnamed category where age is very much upon me, but so much from sex life to work life is alive with change. This could mean that retirement is something I never get to do. But, as Gillian Anderson says, another outcome is that I am open for business in so many ways, ways that now restore more than they exhaust. The perennial, I think, has a rare opportunity to shape this stage, to help redefine how it will one day be approached by women much younger. Maybe there will be two kinds of sex, sex for young people and sex for old people, and the second of those things will give our girls something to look forward to. Mireille Silkoff, who wrote this article, is a writer and cultural critic based in Montreal. She has previously written about celebrities publicly revealing their illnesses, the fading of teen subcultures, and The Golden Bachelor. Before our next article, I just would like to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And our next article from the Screenland section of the New York Times Magazine, The L.A. Fire, Where Something Went Right. While some Angelenos cast around for someone to blame, a whole cooperative emergency response system whirred to life. This article was written by Ryan Francis Bradley. "There is an arsonist here in L.A., Henry Winkler posted on X. It was 10:36 p.m. on Wednesday, January 8th. Almost as soon as the blaze in Pacific Palisades had broken out, the assignment of blame began. The president-elect was blaming the governor. A billionaire mall owner was blaming the mayor. Now, a full day into Los Angeles is burning, responsibility for the fires had been distilled to its purest form. The arsonist. No actual cause for the fires had been determined, but arson was simple. All we had to do now was find this person and stop them. Just hours before Winkler's post, a little before 6 p.m., a new fire, the Sunset Fire, broke out on a steep hillside between Runyon and Nichols Canyons in the Hollywood Hills, a few blocks north of Hollywood and Sunset Boulevards, a famous slice of the Santa Monica Mountains that juts right into the thick of Los Angeles. The night before, across town in Altadena, embers from the Eaton Fire were carried by howling winds and ignited buildings as far as 3 miles away from the fire line. The Sunset Fire could easily have done much worse. It was burning a stone's throw from a swath of L.A. that is among the country's most dense, filled with apartment buildings, commercial blocks, major museums, and even L.A.'s most famous mall, The Grove, which reputedly has more visitors per year than Disneyland. But the Sunset Fire did not burn the city down. Instead, less than 24 hours after it started, it was stopped. It had torched 43 acres of brush surrounded by homes, but it was fully contained and suppressed without destroying a single structure, not even a car. A day after two huge and ultimately cataclysmic burns erupted on opposite ends of the city, after a full 24-hour shift spent trying to firm up defense lines, firefighters not only suppressed the new burn in the Hollywood Hills, but were also combating 3 other major named fires, as well as smaller brush fires throughout the city. There is an app called Watch Duty that tracks wildfires and the response to them. It has, over the past few weeks, been installed on the phones of many, many Angelenos. Anyone who had paid for the members' version would have seen something remarkable that Wednesday. When the Sunset Fire broke out, there were already more than a dozen firefighting craft in the air, by the Pacific Ocean, fighting the Palisades Fire, and to the east around the San Gabriel Mountains, fighting the Eaton Fire. The sky was quickly darkening, visibility was worsening, and the winds were gusting harder and harder. A fixed-wing air attack platform flew overhead, directing aerial traffic. It most likely spotted the smoke from Sunset almost immediately. The pilot would have known that the window to make effective drops was shrinking fast. Suddenly, watch duty displayed many of those aircraft rerouting. They were heading toward Sunset. These were aircraft from all over Southern California and beyond, piloted by crews that rushed in from across the western United States. There were trucks and crews from the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service, from Nevada, Utah, and Oregon, from well over 20 California cities and 7 counties. Orchestrating this kind of ad hoc, real-time response is a devilishly complex task, and pulling off such a quick pivot to suppress another new fire is a true feat of modern management. The system behind it is called NIMS, the National Incident Management System. It is what allowed so many different fire crews to make that quick adjustment and save a significant swath of Los Angeles. The system that led to NIMS was invented here in Southern California. In 1970, a series of fires raged throughout the area. This fire siege, as it came to be known, required agencies to fight a series of fires, a complex fire, across the region's unique blend of wild and urban environments. But the agencies were unable to communicate well. They couldn't coordinate an effective response. The fire burned for 13 days, torching more than 500,000 acres, destroying at least 700 homes and killing 16 people. 2 years later, Congress agreed to fund the firefighting resources of Southern California, organized for potential emergencies project, known as FireScope. And the Forest Service began working with Southern California fire agencies to fix the fire problem. FireScope would grow into NIMS, carrying with it one of the fundamental findings of the whole project. In a fire siege situation, departments needed to pool resources and quickly, and to do that, they needed to set up mutual aid agreements. Yes, At the heart of a federal management system is mutual aid, a concept developed by the Russian anarchist Peter Kropotkin. Mutual aid agreements are common, and not only among firefighters. They crop up almost across almost every agency and at every level of government. They are so common that FEMA publishes an entire guide for mutual aid. The essential nature of these contracts isn't all that different from what Kropotkin identified. Groups that work together, that share and shift their resources toward those most in need, are more successful than groups that do not. Sharing like this is particularly vital in emergency situations because almost no one, and no one department, is fully prepared for an enormous crisis. As FEMA dryly puts it, most jurisdictions do not maintain sufficient resource levels to handle extreme events independently. The rapid shift of resources required to suppress the Sunset Fire is a perfect example of the sort of sharing Kropotkin envisioned, but its success creates an absence. It is seen mostly in things that didn't happen. We can't know how many homes or lives it saved. The Sunset Fire was put out quickly, and because it was put out quickly, it could be forgotten quickly. And yet, the mutual aid agreements that rendered the Sunset Fire forgettable tell us infinitely more about how we are going to go on living here alongside fire and in its aftermath than any assignment of blame, arson, or otherwise. Whom did we envision as the arsonist? Some leaped to report on the homeless and previous fires that started in their encampments. Others were tempted by theories involving energy weapons, DEI practices, or DITI. Those disgusted by tech posted infographics about the amount of water necessary to run AI servers. In our need for the fire to be personal, to be someone's fault, to be a thing someone did to us, we revealed any number of our own hypocrisies. Rick Caruso, the billionaire mall owner who quickly went on TV to blame Mayor Karen Bass, hired a private fire crew to protect his Brentwood home and other properties. But in hiring firefighters away from their own departments, he broke the very chain of mutual aid that ended up beating back the Sunset Fire, a fire that was prevented from ever threatening the Grove, one of Caruso's own malls. Blame is an easier, more visceral, and seemingly actionable emotion than grappling with the fact that monumental fire is a thing that happens and has been happening for millions of years throughout Southern California. I never really understood what it is to live in a place that is predestined to burn until recently, when I became a gardener and got into propagating native seeds. To germinate the seeds of certain lupines, it helps to put them to fire, that is, to heat them up, even under a flame. This is because the plants have evolved to follow fire. Lupines have lived in California some 4.6 million years, humans as little as 15,000. They have figured out how to use fire's heat as a signal, sprouting aggressively in its wake. For us, the fire is similarly revealing. The fire is a mirror. It lays bare our best and our worst, our need for one another. Ryan Francis Bradley, who wrote this article, is a writer based in Los Angeles. And I'm now going to share with you just a couple of the readers' comments to this article. The first is from Eric in the San Francisco Bay Area. As a 33-year-old, professional California firefighter, eight of those as a fire chief, I want to thank you for highlighting the state's mutual aid system. The system is the envy of the world because it can muster massive amounts of resources from neighboring agencies, the region, the state, and ultimately the nation. Unfortunately, it became the best through decades of experience and after-action improvements. There is still work to speed up the ordering process, but fortunately, some brilliant stakeholders are collaboratively working on solutions. These are the same professionals who started the pre-deployment program to deploy resources before any fire started. Over 1,000 fire personnel were pre-deployed for the wind event across California before the Pacific Palisades and Altadena fires broke out. During these sizable mutual aid events, while Californians are sleeping, hundreds of fire engines and thousands of firefighters make their way up and down the state to arrive as quickly as possible. The California Fire Service treats a fire across the state as if it was within its jurisdiction. And from Jen, from Davis, California. Thank you to all the brave fire crews and emergency services personnel that put their lives on the line to save property and lives during the Los Angeles fires. It was an almost impossible task to fight the extremely dry conditions on top of the unyielding winds. All of us in California appreciate the work that you do up and down the state and the western region. And thank you to the writer of the article for discussing the benefits of a system that prioritizes organization, communication, and cooperation to work together on solving problems too big for one agency alone. And now from the diagnosis section of the New York Times Magazine, the bloating and stomach pain were unbearable. What would stop them? This article was written by Lisa Sanders, MD. The 22-year-old woman almost wept as the long line of passengers finally surged forward to the front of the plane. She had been in pain for the entire 90-minute flight. Her abdomen was so distended and tender that she felt as if it might burst. Her seatmates had hidden their irritation as she shifted constantly in her seat in search of a comfortable position. The man in the aisle seat stood up each time she made her way to the bathroom. It didn't do any good. Nothing came out. Not even gas. The Charlotte Douglas International Airport in North Carolina stretched endlessly before her as she hefted her bulky knapsack from one shoulder to the other. Every step jostled her guts uncomfortably. Even without the weight of the pack, standing up straight was strangely difficult, as if a cord inside her was suddenly shorter. She found her mother's car in the line of idling vehicles outside. As she lowered herself into the passenger seat, her mother turned to her. "What's wrong?" she asked. The young woman's face looked rigid with pain. "It was her stomach," the younger woman said. As usual, she'd had problems with her stomach all her life. Going to the bathroom regularly had been an issue for years. Milk gave her cramps, acidic foods gave her heartburn, and her stomach was always off after her college swim team practices. She blamed the mouthfuls of chlorinated water that forced their way in as she sprinted the length of the pool. That at least was over, as she had graduated a few weeks earlier. Both mother and daughter assumed she just had a sensitive stomach, and their pediatrician agreed. It all seemed normal enough. But a few months earlier, the mother noticed a change. A couple of times in their weekly conversations, the symptoms her daughter complained about sounded different, and a lot worse. The girl had always mentioned her sensitive stomach. Now she described constipation, bloating, and intermittent, terrible pain. Once her daughter sounded so awful over the phone that her mother became worried and suggested she go to the emergency room. But these pains never lasted long, her daughter assured her. Seeing her now, clearly in distress, the mother was concerned again. And again her daughter tried to reassure her. She had started to feel better as soon as she left the airplane, she said. What she needed now was a good night's sleep. The next morning she was better, though her mother could see that her stomach was still distended. She ate breakfast eagerly and settled in for a day of relaxing. But by late afternoon the young woman could feel the symptoms returning. She could only eat a couple of mouthfuls of dinner. Her abdomen grew even larger than it had been the night before. The pressure was almost unbearable. She paced around the house, unable to sit, but in pain when she walked. It felt as if her abdomen might explode and some terrible sci-fi creature would burst out. She tried going to the bathroom. She hadn't moved her bowels in days. Nothing. She tried to make herself vomit. She heaved, but only produced a sharp, acidic mouthful of bile. She felt cold, then hot, then cold again. Sweat dripped down her face and drenched her shirt. Her mother, seeing the daughter's distress, brought cool compresses and suggested going to the hospital again and again, her daughter deferring every time. She took a laxative. It didn't help. She lay down and, when that was too painful, resumed her restless pacing. "It's not getting better," her mother announced at last. "We have to go to the ER." It was near midnight when they arrived at the small South Park extension of the Atrium Health Carolinas Medical Center, and the waiting room was practically empty. She was seen almost immediately. A young doctor entered the room and introduced himself. The patient described the strange bouts of bloating, constipation, and pain over the last couple of months. She couldn't identify a trigger, and they had always resolved on their own until that night. On examination, her blood pressure was sky high, probably because of the pain, the nurse told her when she saw the young woman's alarm. Her abdomen bulged upward as she lay on the exam table. It made a strangely hollow noise when the doctor tapped on it. He heard nothing when he placed the stethoscope on her midsection, listening for the noises indicating the gut was functioning. He moved the instrument and listened again, this time for more than a minute. Finally, he heard a tiny gurgle. Her gut was still working, although clearly not normal. Her blood and urine tests were unremarkable. When the doctor returned, he didn't have much to tell them. He wasn't sure what was going on and said that the only other test they could try was a CT scan. It probably wouldn't show much, but was still worth doing. If this was appendicitis or some kind of a mass, they would see it. The doctor came back with the scan results, looking a little puzzled. "You have what is called a volvulus," he intoned gravely. Her lower intestines had twisted themselves into something of a knot. No food could get through, and it looked as if blood was having a hard time getting through as well. This was serious. A real emergency, he told mother and daughter. They didn't usually see this disorder in young people. He had discussed her scan with the surgeon on call, and the recommendation was clear. Her gut had to be untwisted at the main hospital in Charlotte that night. Volvulus occurs when a segment of the colon, usually the sigmoid colon, which is the part just before the rectum, becomes twisted around itself and sometimes the arteries that provide its blood supply. It's an unusual disorder in the United States and is most commonly seen in older adults, usually men, usually over 60. In these more predictable cases, a sedentary lifestyle and chronic constipation are important risk factors. In young people, it is sometimes linked to abnormalities in anatomy, a segment of the colon that is too long or sometimes increased laxity in the arteries, which typically anchor the gastrointestinal tract and prevent too much movement in the abdominal cavity. Symptoms of volvulus include bloating and distension caused by the gas produced by the normal organisms in the gut, which becomes trapped between the two areas of twisting, as well as nausea, pain, and sometimes fever. A volvulus can sometimes resolve on its own, which would explain the intermittent nature of her pain over the previous months, but not this time. The flight, with its reduced cabin pressure, may have worsened the bloating, tightening the twist as the captured gases expanded. She arrived at the main hospital at an hour the girl usually associated with her college parties. It was almost dawn when two surgeons introduced themselves. They would use a camera-guided catheter to open the twisted ends and release the entrapped gas and intestinal contents. The scope could then rotate the gut back to its normal position. When the patient awoke, her abdomen looked and felt nearly normal. The surgeons told mother and daughter that she'd need an additional operation to make sure it didn't twist again. But the following day, her stomach grew once more to its towering height, and the terrible pressure returned. A second CT showed what she already knew. The gut had retwisted itself. That night, she went again to the operating room to have it untwisted. 2 days later, back in the OR, 18 inches of her lower intestines were removed, and the two ends were sewed back together. The cause of the volvulus was unclear. There had been no sign of any anatomic abnormality, but the surgery ensured it would not happen again. By the time she left the hospital 2 days later, she was feeling pretty good. She had no bloating and she could eat. The only pain she had was from the incision across her abdomen. The surgery was 2.5 years ago. She still has the same sensitive stomach she has always had. She still can't eat dairy or gluten. Still feels queasy after she has pushed herself hard in the pool. But she has accepted that that's just who she is. And the 6-inch scar is her only reminder that there was ever anything more. Lisa Sanders, MD, who wrote this article and who writes every article for the diagnosis section of the New York Times Magazine, is a contributing writer for the magazine. Her latest book is Diagnosis: Solving the Most Baffling Medical Mysteries. If you have a solved case to share, write to her at lisa.sandersmdnyt@gmail.com. That's lisa.sandersmdnyt@gmail.com. Thank you very much for joining me for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.